Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Labdhva Nimitam Avyaktam. Labdhva Nimitam Avyaktam. Labdhva nimitam avyaktam. Vyakta vyaktam. Bhavati uta. Vyakta vyaktam bhavatyuta. Vyakta vyaktam bhavatyuta. Labdhva nimitam vyakta avyaktam. Vyakta vyaktam bhavatyuta. Yata yoni yata bijam. Yata yoni yata bijam. Yata yoni yata bijam. Svabhavena valiyasa. Svabhavena baliyasa. Svabhavena baliyasa. Yata yoni yata bijam. Svabhavena baliyasa. Labdhva nimitam avyaktam. Vyakta vyaktam bhavatyuta. Yata yoni yata bijam. Svabhavena baliyasa. Labdhva nimitam avyaktam. Vyakta vyaktam bhavatyuta. Yata yoni yata bijam. Svabhavena baliyasa.
Please. Labdhva, having gotten, nimitam, the cause, avyaktam, unseen or unknown to the person. Vyakta avyaktam, manifested and unmanifested. Or the gross body and the subtle body. Bhavati, come into being. Uta, certainly. Yata yoni, exactly like the mother. Yata bijam, exactly like the father. Sabhavena, by the natural tendency. Baliyasa, which is very powerful. Translation. The fruitive activities a living being performs, whether pious or impious, are the unseen cause for the fulfillment of his desires. This unseen cause is the root for the living entity's different bodies. Because of his intense desire, the living entity takes birth in a particular family and receives a body which is either like that of his mother or like that of his father. The gross and subtle bodies are created according to his desire. Responsively, please. The fruitive activities a living being performs, whether pious or impious, are the unseen cause for the fulfillment of his desires. This unseen cause is the root for the living entity's different bodies. Because of his intense desire, the living entity takes birth in a particular family and receives a body which is either like that of his mother or like that of his father. The gross and subtle bodies are created according to his desire. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The gross body is a product of the subtle body. As stated in Bhagavad Gita 8.6, yam yam vapi smaram bhavam tyajet yante karevaram tang tanga e vaitikunteya saradhad bhavabhavitaha. Whatever state of being one remembers when he quits his body, that state he will attain without fail. The atmosphere of the subtle body at the time of death is created by the activities of the gross body. Thus, the gross body acts during one's lifetime, and the subtle body acts at the time of death. The subtle body, which is called linga, the body of desire, is the background for the development of a particular type of gross body, which is either like that of one's mother or like that of one's father. According to the Rig Veda, if at the time of sex the secretions of the mother are more profuse than those of the father, the child will receive a female body. And if the secretions of the father are more profuse than those of the mother, the child will receive a male body. These are the subtle laws of nature which act according to the desire of the living entity. If a human being is taught to change his subtle body by developing a consciousness of Krishna, at the time of death, the subtle body will create a gross body in which he will be a devotee of Krishna. Or, if he is still more perfect, he will not take another material body, but will immediately get a spiritual body and thus return home back to Godhead. This is the process of the transmigration of the soul. Therefore, instead of trying to unite human society through pacts for sense gratification that can never be achieved, it is clearly desirable to teach people how to become Krishna conscious and return home back to Godhead. This is true now and indeed at any time. So, the verse again. The fruitive activities a living being performs, whether pious or impious, are the unseen cause for the fulfillment of his desires. This unseen cause is the root for the living entity's different bodies. Because of his intense desire, the living entity takes birth in a particular family and receives a body which is either like that of his mother or like that of his father. The gross and subtle bodies are created according to his desire. Omagyan timarandasya kananjana shalakya chakshulam yatam jena tasmai shi gurave namaha So here we see now the Yamadutas are explaining to the Vishnu Dutas why a particular living entity winds up with a particular type of body. And essentially what they're saying is due to desire and fruitive activities, which is taking us back to the start of the chapter. And we see how Sukadeva Goswami is discussing with Parikit Maharaj. Well, if we go back to the previous chapter, Sukadeva Goswami was explaining to Parikit Maharaj about the hellish planets. And then Parikit Maharaj, being a compassionate Vaishnav, and Prabhupada explains in the purport, very much like Prahlad Maharaj, he was concerned to see the living entity suffering. Because, as Prabhupada explains, a Vaishnav has nothing to worry about. Everything's taken care of because he's constantly engaged in remembrance of Krishna. And so Parikit Maharaj was naturally, being a Vaishnav, was naturally very concerned about the suffering condition of the living entities. So therefore he questioned Sukadeva Goswami, well, how did they get out of this? And we see that Sukadeva Goswami, he went through a series of steps explaining different things. And first he starts off with atonement, and then he talks about prayaschitta, then he talks about knowledge, and then he talks about, tapasya and things like that. And Parikit Maharaj basically didn't accept his presentation. He's saying, the word is there is kunja sochavat, it's just like the bathing of an elephant. The elephant, it takes bath and it comes out and throws dirt all over its body. So it's kind of a pointless activity. And then, so Sukadeva Goswami says, yes, actually, you've understood the point. Is that because, atonement or these other things in themselves are fruitive activities, so they have no capacity to purify one of fruitive activities. So then he goes on to explain that actually the real essence of how one can escape from this material world is bhakti. And this is the point of this section of the Bhagavatam, is that the compassionate nature or the nurturing nature of the Lord, and how he's kind and caring towards the devotees. And for one who takes to the path of bhakti, even if their endeavor is somewhat maybe even incomplete, like we see here with this story is about Ajamil, and his practice of bhakti was far from perfect. He'd been practicing for some time, and then he fell victim to his desires and wound up in a very, very abominable situation, performing all kinds of abominable activities. Yet because of this one act of bhakti, calling out the name of his son without offense, then he was saved from a very, very difficult life. And this is the point of this whole section, and this is why this story is being told by Sukadeva Goswami, is because it demonstrates very clearly the potency of the process of bhakti. How that even he just once he called, and especially the name, it's the whole discussion here is really about the potency of the holy name of the Lord, and how he chanted the Lord's name once without offense, and all this past activities, his past sinful activities, were overcome by this once chanting the holy name. So he was actually able to achieve a situation where ultimately he was able to go back home to Godhead. So this is the importance of this section, particularly this sixth canto, where it's dealing quite specifically about how the Lord is caring for the devotees, and how when we take shelter of the process of bhakti, then one can very quickly overcome. And Prabhupada, in different places, he uses this Vedic aphorism, he calls it. It says, asangohi yayam purusha, that the living entity cannot be actually touched by matter. It's not possible, because the nature of the living entity is spiritual. It's very much like I was just in Konoj. As some of you may know, my service is in ISKCON deity worship ministry, and always looking for ways to improve how we're serving the deity. So I was there, researching some manufacturers of oil, different scented oils for the deities. And when you make oil, one of the things they do when they make oils is through the distillation process, the oil comes into a settling container where it cools down after they distill it. And in that container is water, and the oil goes into the water. But because of the nature of oil, it's lighter than water, and it won't mix with water. It doesn't. You can shake it up, it'll froth up, and it'll all separate out. So that's just the nature. Oil will not mix with water. So in the same way, the nature of the jiva because it's transcendental. It actually can't be touched by matter. So Prabhupada explains, using this aphorism, that when the living entity returns to the natural state of Krishna consciousness, then very quickly this Krishna consciousness is awoken. I mean, all I have to do is look at my own life and, you know, go back, you know, 30, 40 years and look at what I was doing and look at where I am now. And it's just so different. I mean, it's just so completely different from, you know, what I was doing 40 years ago. And so this just, for me, just reconfirms this understanding, is that the living entity cannot be touched by matter. And when the living entity comes into contact again with this transcendental path, then very quickly that original consciousness is reawoken. Even though prior to that contact, it's just, you know, you have no idea of the reality of this world. You have no idea of the reality of the self. But through this contact with Krishna consciousness, that consciousness is very quickly restored. And therefore Prabhupada explains that it doesn't take very long for a living entity, you know, if you calculate it in terms of the many millions of lifetimes we spent here in this material world, the amount of time it takes for us to return to that original consciousness is very short indeed. So I remember as a young devotee, I was kind of, you know, always had this sort of anxiety and frustration, or when am I going to become a pure devotee? When am I going to become a pure devotee? I wanted it sort of to happen straight away. But then as I progressed in devotional service, obviously, you know, to become completely purified and, you know, completely surrendered to the lotus feet of Krishna is the goal. But a bit more patience is there now, because I'm seeing, you know, how rapidly progress has been made in spiritual life. If I take it on a day-to-day thing, then obviously I'm not seeing much happening. But if I take it in terms of my period in ISKCON and the progress I've made, then I think this is quite an amazing process, how really quickly we can actually come back to that original state. And this is, you know, as we go through this pastime, particularly the story of Ajamila, which is in the first six chapters here, we see how, you know, he chants the name of Narayan, he has this contact with the Vishnu Dutas, then he goes to Haridwar, and for one life he performs various acts of purification to overcome his past sinful acts, and then he returns back home to Godhead very quickly. You know, and yet he'd been millions of lifetimes in the material world. It's the same for all of us. Millions and millions, countless. You know, Prabhupada, he often, you know, like this term, eternally conditioned. He explains that actually it's not eternal, but you've been here for so many lifetimes, you can't trace out the beginning. We've been so long in this material world, we can't actually fathom how long. But there was a point when we weren't here. There was a point when we were in the spiritual world, according to Srila Prabhupada. And yet, you know, we come to Krishna consciousness, one life, two life, maybe a few short lifetimes, and we return back to that original condition. So it's amazing, you know, when the living entity comes into touch with the spiritual process, how quickly it washes away this material conditioning. And this is the point, the main point that's being demonstrated, and also the power of the holy name to, you know, just Chaito Dharpana Marjana, to actually remove this conditioning of the living entity. And also we see in this verse is describing a little bit about the process of how one receives a body. There's an interesting verse, I think it's the first verse actually. Kapila Dev speaks about the movements of the living entity, which is Kamana Deva Netrena. Janto Deha Pate Striya Pavishturam Pungsureta Kanashaya. So a very interesting verse where he's talking about how, according to his desire, and, you know, it's his kamana, according to one's activities, Deva Netrena, and under the supervision of the divine, the living entity enters into the particle of semen, and then through that is injected into the womb of a woman, and to receive a particular type of body. So the Vedic explanation of all these things is quite scientific, because we see that the materialistic idea is that, you know, a male, female, they have sex, and a living entity is created from that. But if we look at this verse, it says, Pungsa Retta Kanashaya. So this Retta Kanashaya is indicating how the semen is actually the carrier for the living entity. The living entity enters in, but it's not actually the source of life. It's just a carrier. Very much like a vehicle is carrying a person. You know, the vehicle's not creating the person, just carrying the person. And then when there's, as it talks about here in this purport, the emulsification between the semen and the egg, then a body is, you know, generated through the various process, and then the living entity comes out. And even, you know, it's very scientifically explained here how that if the secretions of the woman are greater, then a female child occurs, and if the secretions of the male are greater, then a male child occurs. So, you know, the Vedic science is very exact and specific about all these different things. Whereas we see here, this verse is talking about this avyakta-vyakta, you know, how seen and unseen forces are acting. And the scientific mind, when it looks at, you know, at least the materialistic scientific mind, when it looks at this material world, it can only see the seen. Everything that the scientists are doing is based on observable phenomena. It's not based on metaphysical things. At least most of the scientists like that. So, you know, when you try to explain things to them in the terms of things that they can't observe, then they say, oh, this is all mythology, or this is all, you know, imagination. They don't accept it. Yet, interestingly enough, as their scientific methods become more and more refined, they're actually starting to discover more and more of these subtle things that are going on in this world. Just to give a simple example, where I live in Australia, I live on a farm. If anyone ever comes to Australia, please come and visit. It's a very, very beautiful farm. Nothing to do with me living there, but I could easily say it's probably the most beautiful farm in ISKCON. I've visited probably most of the farms in ISKCON, and this is a particularly amazing part of the world. Anyhow, so as you would sort of guess, on a farm, there's some farming going on. And then with farming and talking to the devotees there who are involved in the farming, I'm starting to learn a little bit about how things work in nature. And even like, you know, the environment in Australia, just learning a little bit about that. And the more I learn about how things happen in nature, the more I'm struck by the incredible nature, you know, the incredible sort of arrangement that Krishna's made for everything to happen. Even like, you know, devotees are talking about soil structure and how in the top of the soil there's all these microbes that interact with the air and all this, they bring nitrogen and this thing and that thing, and just so many different things that are going on in the soil, which if you go back 20 years ago, people didn't have the knowledge. But we see in the Vedic science, all these things are explained in great detail. And now as they're becoming more and more refined and they're exploring more and more into their little, into the details of what's going on, they're discovering more and more about it. But it's kind of interesting because nonetheless, they still conclude that it's all going on by chance. I was in the airport in Perth some years ago, and I was sitting next to this man who works for an organization in Australia called the CSIRO, which is it's a government research organization. It's the government science organization. They, you know, research all different types of things, scientific, you know, solar energy and food technology and all that sort of stuff. Anyhow, so I was having this conversation with this gentleman, and he was a scientist working with CSIRO, and his particular branch of science was to understand the mechanics of the cell wall in a single-celled living entity. His whole life was just devoted to this thing. And so I was having this conversation with him, trying to explain to him how that life doesn't come from matter, and life comes from life. Couldn't accept it. Just couldn't accept it at all. His conclusion was that everything was by chance. And, you know, he was sitting there playing on his laptop, you know, working, whatever it was. And then just as we were coming in, the plane was arriving at the gate. It was a jumbo jet. And so I thought, okay, this is a good chance for analogy. And I said, this computer's really complicated, right? And he says, yeah. And I said, it requires intelligence to make such a thing. And he agreed. And I said, and now we see this plane coming in. And the plane, so much more complicated than this little computer. He said, you've got no idea how much more complicated. And I said, therefore, you know, and we can understand, this requires intelligence to make this. And he agreed. He said, yes. And I said, well, then you're telling me the computer's complicated, the jumbo jet's complicated. How complicated is the cell wall, the mechanics in the cell wall? He says, so much more complicated than a jumbo jet. And I said, and that requires intelligence to make such a thing, doesn't it? He said, no, it came about by chance. So this is the classic example of maya prahitajnana. Their knowledge is stolen by illusion. They cannot understand because it's unseen. You know, when they play with a computer, or they make a computer, or they make a plane, they can see what's going on. They can manipulate the material energy. It's all about control. They can manipulate the material energy to produce a particular outcome. But with a living entity, because when it comes to the jiva or the body or anything like that, it's to them it's come about by chance because they haven't manipulated the material energy to produce that. Therefore, they think it's all by chance. They can't do it. You know, and again, it's kind of an element of false ego because they're thinking no one's more intelligent than them. You know, I can't do it, no one can do it. You know, they can't accept God because how could someone be greater than me? I'm the smartest person in the world. How could anyone be greater than me? So therefore, because of their pride, their false ego, they're bewildered. Their knowledge is stolen by illusion. And they'll never, you know, what's that verse that says, Parato Satoba, by their own endeavors, by the endeavor of others, or by a combination of both, they'll never understand the truth. They can never understand the reality of what's going on in this world. But only, you know, and this is the point that's being made earlier on in this chapter, only when they have this contact with a pure devotee, through, you know, because Sukadeva Goswami is pointing this out for Rikki Maharaj, through bhakti, but ultimately through service through the pure devotees, then one can actually come to the spiritual path. One can overcome the chain of fruitive activities. So, this, from my perspective, that's the importance of this chapter, is to understand how only through bhakti, and specifically through the association of the Vaishnavas, can we overcome this condition we find ourselves in the material world. By our own endeavors, we'll never, you know, by performing prayaschitta, by studying the scriptures, by all these different things, you know, atonement, whatever, we'll never actually achieve the goal of life. It's only through this process of bhakti that one can achieve the goal of life, and specifically through the association and guidance of advanced Vaishnavas, one can actually achieve the goal of life. So that's why, you know, Srila Prabhupada has created this movement to give us this opportunity and others the opportunity to associate with Vaishnavas and practice Krishna consciousness. And, you know, things like deity worship and all these other activities are just assistance to this process. You know, they help us to get to the point of bhakti. You know, deity worship is not, you know, even though that's my calling in spiritual life, if you like, I don't see deity worship as the final goal. Deity worship has a specific purpose. Deity worship is there is to facilitate our chanting of Hare Krishna, because that's the main process in this age. And Prabhupada explained it to Giriraj Maharaj. Giriraj Maharaj told me this years ago that he wanted us to keep the process of deity worship simple, because he said if we get too, you know, caught up in the rituals, etc. I mean, because the more you get into deity worship, the more you see there's just so many rituals and so many rules and regulations and this thing and that thing. And I've seen many times where devotees, they get so caught up in all this sort of stuff, they forget everything else. They think this is it. There's no more to devotional service than this. And they actually forget that the process is hearing and chanting. It's just such a simple thing. And it's what works most effectively in this age. And Jiva Goswami in his Bhakti Sandarbha, he explains that it is actually the conclusion of the Srimad Bhagavatam that deity worship and the process of initiation are actually not necessary. But then he goes on to explain, but as far as we have experienced, that all those who approach us for initiation are so contaminated by the modes of material nature that deity worship is essential. And he was saying this like, you know, 470 years ago. Things have changed a bit, I think. You know, things have become even more difficult. So, yes, it's essential, but it has a purpose. Its purpose is to help us become purified so that we can ultimately just focus on the holy name of the Lord. And that's the association of devotees. It helps us to understand, you know, the importance of chanting. It helps us to understand how to chant. How, you know, the whole process is just to bring us to this point of taking shelter of the name.
So I'll finish there. Is there any questions at all?
Yeah, chanting is definitely sufficient. So the limitation is not the chanting, the limitation is us. Because we're not sufficiently purified, the mind is not peaceful. We're agitated by the modes of nature, we're agitated by the mind and the senses. Therefore we can't focus on hearing and chanting sufficiently. If you look at someone like Thakur Haridas, he was so peaceful within himself that he could sit and chant 24 hours a day without having to worry about eating or sleeping or sex life or any of these things. You look at the six Goswamis of Vrindavan. They were so absorbed in their bhajan that they would forget to eat. They would forget to sleep. They're just so absorbed in Krishna consciousness. That's the type of consciousness you need to simply be absorbed in the chanting of the holy name. So we need this. It's the difference between Pancharatrik Vidhi and Bhagavat Vidhi. The Pancharatrik Vidhi is specifically for purification. That's why Prabhupada would say we follow these two parallel lines, because we need this purification. Right now, we're conditioned by material modes of nature. We're convinced we're the body. Maybe you're not, but I know I am. I'm convinced I'm the body. I act with that understanding. The things I do, I'm acting because I think I'm the body. You know? I mean, intellectually I understand I'm not, but in reality I don't. You know, I don't have the vijnana. So therefore, through this process of purification, and definitely I've seen, at least in my own example, I can see that, you know, when I first walked through the door of the temple to now, that my identification with the body is reducing more and more. But still, I'm not at this point where I can just sit down and chant Hare Krishna. You know, my body hurts, my mind's agitated, there's this, there's that. There's all these different things going on, distracting me from the chanting. So by performing deity worship, you know, because, see, one of the acts you do when you perform deity worship is all these things we would normally do for ourselves. You know, like, I have the nature where I like to dress in nice clothes, I like to, you know, smell nice oils and things like that. So I can do that, and that's just going to increase my bodily concept. But if I take the same things and I offer them to Krishna, then that has, you know, it's like Krishna's, you know, described as being very expert in the nectar devotion, because every activity achieves so many different things. Every activity he does, he accomplishes so many different things. So when we're offering something like that to the deity, I satisfy Krishna, the living entity who the oils come from or the cloth has come from or whatever, gets the benefit, the person, you know, the whole sort of process there. But also, I'm giving up my identification with the body. Imperceptibly is changing. So by making that connection with deity worship, we're giving up all these identifications gradually.
Is it like that with a conditioned mind and like the Lord and words of nature, it is easier to perform deity worship than to chant within himself?
Much easier. Because because like this the mind and the body are agitated by the most nature. You've got it, you know, it's just like, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen with animals like cows. You know, when I was younger, I used to do a lot of work on cattle stations in Australia. And the thing is with a cow, you can't just tell it, go here. You've got to put it into such a situation where it can't do anything else. It can only go that way. So the mind is like that when it's uncontrolled. The unbridled mind, you can't ask it, please, my dear mind, can you do this? Because it's just not going to listen. It's just going to steamroll through you and just go where it wants to go. If it sees the object of the senses, it's just going to target straight for that. So the idea is we have to force the mind, force the senses in a particular way. And this is, Krishna explains this in the sixth chapter of the Gita, how we need to, you know, force the mind to take shelter of the devotional process. And in that way, the mind becomes controlled. And in that way, we can start to focus seriously. Because, you know, it's described in various parts of the Bhagavatam, it's only when we have this mind controlled and it's focused on the Lord, that's the point where we start to do bhakti. Up until that, it's kind of a bit mixed. But when the mind is controlled, when the senses are controlled, we're focused exclusively on Krishna, that's real bhakti. Is that okay? I hope everyone can understand my Australian accent. Probably a bit difficult.
Hare Krishna. The purpose of deity worship is the purpose of initiation to engage in the deity worship. Now there are many who undergo only first initiation, and only those who undergo second initiation they can perform the deity worship. So how come, like, those who undergo first initiation and yet do not, yet they can attain the perfection because they are not doing the deity worship. Even those who have accepted second initiation, there are many who do not perform deity worship. So just on the basis of first initiation, how they are performing any type of deity worship.
I guess there's different ways you can look at this question. Just because one's initiated or uninitiated doesn't mean you can't do deity worship. It just means you can't touch the deity if you're not a Brahmin. But, you know, you can clean deity paraphernalia, you can make garlands for the deities. There's so many things you can do. You can offer prayers to the deities. There's so many things you can do without being a Brahmin. So you can do deity worship and you can get the benefit of deity worship. You know, just if you look in the Nectar of Devotion, I think it's chapters 5 and 6, it describes 64 activities of devotional service. 35 of those activities are directly deity worship. So more than half of what we're doing is directly deity worship, and many of the other items are not so direct. Now, you know, prior to Srila Prabhupada is my understanding. I mean, I've heard different explanations of this, but my understanding is prior to Srila Prabhupada, there was only one initiation. And you just got, you know, Diksha, and you got Gayatri Mantra at that time. I have heard some say that Bhaktisiddhanta did it, but I'm not sure on that. I mean, maybe someone else knows better than I do. But the point is that it was, at some point it was broken into two stages. Yeah? And I've also heard different explanations of why, but it seems like one of the main ideas behind that was, you know, especially when, I guess, with Srila Prabhupada dealing with devotees in the West. Let's take a look back a little bit further. Say, for instance, you go back to the time of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. There is no evidence that I'm aware of where he ever actually gave diksha to anyone, yet there were many people who saw him as, you know, they considered themselves his disciple. So if we look back in those times, then people took the process much more seriously. These days, you know, you have to make a big show of things. Like, if we look at Srila Prabhupada, there's only two sets of deities Prabhupada ever installed formally. These deities here and the deities in Hyderabad. Most deities, he put them on the altar, he got a pot of yogurt and a soup ladle and bathed them. And that was about it. You know, but nowadays we find we're doing these very, very elaborate ceremonies that take 3 days and, you know, take up half the temple room and, you know, rituals and mantras and this thing and that thing. And part of the idea with that is to impress upon the mind of neophyte devotees that something significant has happened here. So my understanding of part of the reason for separating the diksha into two stages there was to also make that impression. But it's not that, you know, because one's only taken first initiation, they're not making progress. Because if you don't make progress, then how are you going to get, you know, Pancharatra Gayatri Diksha?
You know, you need to, yeah, make progress. Just by the main point of the diksha is a formal connection to the sampradaya. That's the main point of it. You've become formally connected to the sampradaya, and that then puts you in a situation where you become eligible to return back to Godhead at some point. Generally speaking, it's understood that without diksha, it's very difficult to return to Godhead. Is that okay?
You said that at the beginning of your talk that when one gets to Krishna consciousness, one makes progress very quickly. But later on you said that progress is gradual. Is it that initially you said progress is gradual and you made reference to yourself and you still find yourself identifying yourself with your body and stuff? Is it that initially we, because of the knowledge of Krishna consciousness, we are very eager to advance and we make advancement, but then down the road when we see how demanding it is to become pure devotees, that we begin to slow down?
Yeah, interesting question. Personally, I don't see Krishna consciousness as very demanding. I find it very satisfying. In the beginning stages, yeah, I was struggling with the mind, struggling with the senses, and this whole, my life was just basically turned upside down completely. It was just so different from anything I'd ever done before. So that was a struggle. But now, after 30 plus years in devotional service, I find it very satisfying. I don't find it difficult at all. I mean, I find my body difficult. That's what I find difficult. And just, trying to do things every day, challenging. Rupa Goswami explains this point very clearly in the second chapter, I think it is, of the Nectar of Devotion. And he explains that, the only cause for one to come to devotional service is past life devotional service, unless one has a contact with a pure devotee. What he explains is that in a past life you've done devotional service, so when you come into contact with devotional service, very quickly you progress to that point you were at in your past life. And then from that point on, you make steady progress. That's one way of looking at it. The other point, in terms of how I was describing it, if you look at it in the context of the whole time you've been here in this material world, yeah, countless lifetimes, you just cannot figure it out. There's just so many lifetimes you've been here. And then to come to bhakti and then to take to the process of hearing and chanting and serving the deity and things like that, that's really rapid. But when I look at it from my perspective, my conditioned perspective here and now, it's very gradual. So you see the angle I'm giving there, it's like from my perspective here and now it's very gradual, but from the bigger perspective of my life in this material world, it's really rapid. Yeah? Okay. Dharmatma.
Thank you for such a nice class. My question is that you mentioned that deity worship is a means to purification, it's not an end in itself. So does the same principle apply for preaching as well?
The main reason I'm saying that deity worship is not the end in itself is because it's not the process for this age. As simple as that. I mean, you can achieve perfection through deity worship, there's no doubt of that. And Prabhupada, in a letter to, I think it was Govindadasi or Rukmini, anyhow, one of those two Vaishnavis, it was Hangsadhu's wife, Himavati, and he talks about the process of Archana Siddhi. And he said that you can achieve perfection through the process of deity worship, and then at the end of this life, you go directly back to the spiritual world. Because through that process, you're actually, through deity worship, you're actually engaged directly in the Lord's pastimes, and you go back to the spiritual world. Prabhupada's point and the point of our acharyas is that it's not the process for this age. It doesn't mean you can't achieve perfection. Just as we see there's 9 processes of devotional service, you can achieve perfection through any of those processes. But in this age, the most effective process is Harinama, Harinama, Harinama Eva Kevalam. That's the most effective process. Preaching is a part of that. It's the same thing. It's not like it's different. Because when you go out and you present Krishna consciousness to people, what ultimately you're trying to get them to do? Exactly. So what's the difference? There's no difference. It's kirtan. So, yeah, I'm not saying that you don't need to do deity worship, because otherwise I'd be out of a job. But my point is like, don't make it too elaborate. Don't make it too complicated. Keep it simple. Like sometimes I've heard the comment with Radha Raman, for instance, that, oh, the worship there is so simple, they should do this, they should do that. But the fact is they've been doing that worship there for 400 years. That's what we need to look at in ISKCON. Is, the Sangatana mission is supposed to go on for 10,000 years. We need to make sure that in 10,000 years' time we're still worshipping these deities to the same degree that we're worshipping them now. The same degree of opulence, the beautiful flower decorations, the dressing, everything like that. We need to maintain that. Not we just keep expanding, 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 expanding. And then, 100 years down the track, like we saw, in the late 70s and early 80s, there was such a push for expansion in the movement. And then, come late 80s and 90s, it all crashed. And still there's temples around the world that haven't recovered from that. They still have non-Brahmins on the altar. They still have non-Brahmins cooking for the deities. They still have the poor standards of cleanliness. They still have, they cut the offerings back. One temple I know in Europe, they're only doing 3 offerings a day now for a Radha Krishna temple. So because of this like crazy expansionistic kind of idea, they just pushed the standards so high and they couldn't maintain it. Everything collapsed. So, I see now that, we're a little bit more, hopefully, in the mode of goodness with these things and thinking about it a little more carefully before we install deities, and not just go ahead and install deities without any thought of the future. Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki, samaveta bhakti vrinda ki, jaya jaya gopremanandiyo.